This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
You pay your money, you get, usually, to buy a gun. Public policy as business transaction on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 13th of June. Good as always to have you with us, everybody, although one does wish it were under different circumstances. While police and others in Orlando unpack the events of early Sunday morning, a few thoughts about the business of guns in this country, the transactions in which money is exchanged for firearms. Transactions that, it has to be noted, the FBI says were completely legal in the Orlando shooting. Shannon Pettypiece covered the gun industry for Bloomberg News. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
This is, in no small measure, a story about what consumers can do when they go to the store and plunk down their money, right?
Right. Exactly. I mean, guns are an item that's sold in big retailers, like everything from camo pants to camping equipment in a lot of stores.
And so what have retailers been doing in the past? I mean, it's been, 4 or 5 years now since Sandy Hook. How do the folks like Walmart's and sporting goods stores react?
We've actually seen very little reaction from the retailers. Walmart, which is the biggest seller of guns in America, they came out last year and said that they were going to stop selling the AR-15 and similar military-style rifles that have been used in a number of these mass shootings. But Walmart said that that decision was purely business-based. It had nothing to do with political outcry about guns or any of these mass shootings. They said the guns just weren't selling that well, and they were taking up valuable real estate on the store shelf space that they could put to better use elsewhere. After Sandy Hook, Dick's Sporting Goods stopped selling these military-style rifles. Now, retailers have taken other steps to try and improve standards around gun sales. Walmart has strengthened some of the areas around its background checks. They record every gun purchase and lock up their ammo just voluntarily, but not, again, in response to any of these mass shootings of late.
They are also, these retailers, dealing, as are consumers, I guess, with a raft of state laws, right? Because while there has been, generally speaking, federal inaction, it's been left to the states to regulate weapons purchases.
Yeah, and it really varies state by state. I mean, even, for example, in Texas, where they have these new concealed carry laws, in some cases it's up to the retailers, like Walmart, to actually police and make sure that people do have a license for a weapon that they're carrying. Other cases, the retailers have decided that they will go above and beyond what the law requires, either sort of out of a way to be a good corporate citizen or just to sort of make things uniform across all of their stores.
What about the long tail of firearms retail? Because it's not all Walmarts and Dicks, right? I mean, you got mom and pops all over the place.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, you could have the biggest retailers, Cabela's, Gander Mountain, Walmart, just stop selling guns altogether. But a huge share, the majority of guns in this country are purchased at mom and pop shops or at gun shows, online, secondhand, people selling them. So, even if the big retailers all got on board and took some big action on their own outside of any regulation, it's not going to, completely radicalize the way guns are sold in the country because the industry is so fragmented.
Do you get any sense as you're talking to these retailers, big or small, that they are self-regulating in the face of possible legislation, either at the federal or state level?
They really maintain that it's all about business. And last year I did an article on this, and I was really pressing Walmart, and they said, no, this is pure business decision. It's about keeping their customers safe. It's about doing what's best for their business. No retailer has really yet come up and said it has anything to do with the anti-gun lobby or anything that's being said in Washington.
Shannon Pettypiece at Bloomberg News. Shannon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
When Orlando and things like it happen, people obviously worry about their loved ones. Business owners do too, of course, with the added burden of fears for the safety of their employees and their customers. Those fears are in turn driving a large and growing private security industry in this country. So we asked Marketplace's Mark Garrison to take a look at what we're calling Security Inc.
It's a delicate matter to talk business after so many Americans lose their lives for nothing more than being present at a gay and lesbian nightclub. So those in the security industry are cautious in discussing how shootings affect their companies. They say, unfortunately, a lot. Sandy Jones is a consultant in the field.
The security industry is resilient, unfortunately, because bad things happen.
U.S. private sector security spending is around $400 billion a year. Growth is strong in recent years. Some of that is new spending on technology, particularly cybersecurity. But fear of gun violence is a driver, too. Steve Amate runs the National Association of Security Companies, which represents security guard firms. He says previous shootings drove companies to hire more guards. He thinks Orlando could have similar impact.
They will be increasing their security because this is now kind of, unfortunately, a known risk.
The security industry is a mix of big companies and small. Some are household names. Others are specialized, like Securitas, a big global player in security guards. G4S is another big company in that space. It's in the news now because it once employed the Orlando shooter. G4S says he passed detailed screenings. The customers of the security industry are business owners and managers. Michael Gibbs is with ASIS International, a membership organization that represents the people who have to decide what to do to keep their employees and customers safe.
There's a lot of pressure. The stakes and consequences of all your actions are extremely high.
In the months to come, we'll see how much impact Orlando has on how businesses think about security and how that might change the places we work, shop, and play. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, here's one you probably knew without looking. It happens every time. Shares of the two big gun makers, Smith & Wesson and Sturm Ruger, up sharply. The major indices, not so much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. $26.2. Yes, the standard distance in miles for a marathon. It's also the price in billions of dollars that Microsoft is going to pay for the business networking site LinkedIn. It's the biggest internet software deal ever, also Microsoft's largest acquisition by a long shot, which raises the entirely reasonable question of what is so attractive about a social network that earlier this year managed to lose nearly half its stock price in a single day. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has more on what Microsoft sees in LinkedIn.
These two companies are aiming seriously high. In a call with investors today, LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner said their long-term vision is to change how work happens and ultimately
help transform and lift the global economy.
Weiner and Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella say in their vision, every working person will have a LinkedIn profile so employers all over the world can find who they want when they want. All this assumes a global future that's churny, with people coming and going from jobs even more than they do now. Arvind Malhotra, a professor at the University of North Carolina Business School, says it's plausible.
Freelance work and working on the fly jobs is definitely on the rise.
What could be tougher is for Microsoft to actually pull it off. Mary Shea is an analyst at Forrester. She agrees it's all about the execution, but she says it fits with the direction Microsoft is taking, providing software and services to business.
I think it's a fantastic and bold move for Microsoft.
The big idea is that Microsoft takes LinkedIn and its 433 million users and hooks that up with more than a billion users of Microsoft Office into a giant social network they can eventually monetize.
It puts Microsoft in a really terrific position to compete against some of the big players, Facebook, Google, and Salesforce, as they go into the 21st century.
Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella has a lot riding on this. If the whole thing doesn't gel, he might need to work on his own LinkedIn profile. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
You hear the phrase troubled company a lot. Sometimes it's a bit hyperbolic. Yahoo, for instance, yes, is in a bind, has been for a while, but there is talk of at least one $3 billion bid for its core assets on the table. Valeant Pharmaceuticals, on the other hand, is pretty much a hot mess. It is smack in the middle of a slew of federal and state investigations for price gouging. The company's shareholders, big Wall Street hedge funds mostly, are scrambling to salvage their investments and their reputations. Bethany McLean is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. She's got the story of Valeant and its troubles in the magazine's current issue. Bethany, it's good to have you on again.
Thanks for having me.
Place to start, I think, with this company and this article is Michael Pearson, the now former CEO of Valeant, right? Tell us a little bit about him.
So what's fascinating about Mike Pearson is how he became such a cult leader with very smart, supposedly very smart, investors on Wall Street. He's an unlikely cult hero in that he didn't seem like the master of the universe type that these sort of guys would normally follow. And yet he exerted this strangely powerful hold over his many, many followers, such that even when it was obvious to outsiders that the business wasn't what it was cracked up to be, these investors who followed him just simply couldn't see it.
Is it too simple to say that the business model was to buy up either companies or drug patents and essentially jack up the price?
I don't think it is too simple to say that. I think it's becoming quite clear that that is exactly what the business model was. Defenders of the company would always argue, well, that's just around the edges. There's a whole substantive business here that doesn't rely on this at all. But we're seeing now that remaining business is very weak. The stock price cracked, and it's down some 90%. It's been the loss of something like $90 billion in market cap, which, if you think about it, is bigger than Enron, bigger than Bernie Madoff. This story is an unmitigated disaster, both for patients and for investors, although one set arguably doesn't deserve it at all, and the other set arguably deserves it quite a bit.
Give me a for instance. You start the piece with what is called in the trade an anecdotal lead about these two women had this copper deficiency and they needed one of these Valeant drugs to live.
Well, that was actually how I got started on this story, is that one of the women is a friend of mine, and somehow we were talking a little bit about Valeant, and she said, oh, I know that company. I have Wilson's disease. And Wilson's disease is a disease where you can't properly metabolize copper, and it's fatal. You die of either liver disease or neurological conditions. It's not pleasant. And a British pharmacist in the 1950s came up with two pretty simple drugs to treat these diseases. He was just monkeying around. This wasn't some big, elaborate billion-dollar R&D process. Called cyprine and cupramine. And for years, Merck, the big pharmaceutical giant, owned these drugs and sold them for a dollar a pill. And then Merck sold these two drugs to another firm who then in turn sold them to Valeant. And Valeant began to hike the price of the drugs. Today, one of them, cyprine, is now about $300,000 a year.
And you need these drugs to live if you have Wilson's disease.
That was sort of Mike Pearson's argument, which was because people need these drugs to live, either the people or the insurance system will pay any amount to keep them alive because, hey, it's cheaper than liver failure. Although now it came out in recent congressional testimony that actually the cost of a liver replacement is cheaper than the cost of cyprine.
The through line of this company and its history with its investors and really the whole deal is shareholder value, right? Mike Pearson was jacking up these prices to increase the share price of his company stock. Investors wanted that. They made boatloads of money. And yet it all turns out to have been a sham.
So that, to me, is the heart of this and why it's a larger story than even this story, is that it was all done in the name of this concept of shareholder value. For a long time, there was this kind of compact in the drug industry that, yes, we in the United States let you price your products at very high levels, but the sort of implicit trade-off was, and you're going to invest money in developing other products that might save people's lives. This company turned that on its head and said, oh, no, no, we're not going to do the investing. We're just going to make all the money that we possibly can by taking advantage of the pricing opportunities here in the United States.
Bethany McLean is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. Her most recent piece in the magazine this month is called The Valeant Meltdown and Wall Street's Major Drug Problem. Bethany, thanks. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
I swear we didn't plan it this way, but if we could have, we would have. In the second half of the program today, the first installment of a week-long series looking at shareholder value and what happens when corporations make that their strategy. coming up.
In the middle of the 20th century, it was the most admired, the most widely respected company in the world.
Any guesses, anybody? Three little letters. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 132 points today, about 0.7%, 17,732. The NASDAQ off 46 points, 0.9%, 4848. A little symmetry there. The S&P 500 down 17 points, 0.8%, 2,079. Brexit fears seem to be the thing. LinkedIn shareholders like the news of Microsoft's acquisition of their company, which we just told you about. LinkedIn shares up 46%. Microsoft, on the other hand, dropped 0.2%. Apple opened its annual conference for software developers today. Yes, so what? Apple shares down 1.5%. Alphabet inched down 0.1%. CBS drew 9 million people to the Tony Awards last night, the highest ratings for that award show in 15 years. Hamilton, what do you think? CBS shares off 1.1%, though. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to that idea now that Bethany McLean and I ended with, this thing that has come to be called shareholder value. Companies like Valiant, as we were talking about, jumping through hoops to maximize profits and give money back to shareholders. Shareholders that sometimes, yes, are directly mom-and-pop investors, but increasingly are hedge funds and Wall Street insiders. And the thing is that corporations have made conscious decisions to change their priorities to make profits their most important product. So to begin our week-long series about shareholder value, we're calling it the price of profits, this question. What are corporations for? Why are they in business? Dan Bobkoff, an editor with our partner on this project, Business Insider, starts things off.
For those of us feeling insecure about our jobs and our futures, the story I'm about to tell may sound like a fairy tale. Imagine for a moment an employer that takes care of you from cradle to grave, one that hosts lavish carnivals for your family, a place where workers feel intensely loyal because they're treated so well. That company was IBM.
In the middle of the 20th century, it was the most famous, the most admired, the most widely respected company in the world.
Quinn Mills is professor emeritus at Harvard Business School and wrote books about IBM and its culture. There were even company-owned country clubs where any employee, executive, or factory worker could play and golf for pennies. You can still find retired IBMers like Ron Diedrich grumbling on the green at one of them in Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, he used to play for nothing. Now it costs me like $3,000 a year.
IBM sold the course in the 90s. It was just one hit to what had been an IBM core value, what it called respect for the individual. If you got in, they'd take care of you in a big way, says Professor Mills.
What that meant in IBM was that people were not laid off for lack of work. When IBM's business turned down, the company found other ways to employ, to use its people.
It's true. From its early days in the 1920s, through the Depression, wars, the oil crisis, you name it, IBM went more than seven decades without a layoff. Mills says the company's founder, Thomas Watson, called it full employment.
He believed that people worked better when they were secure, not insecure. He believed that people would make a full commitment to the company if they knew that they could count on the company to make a full commitment to them.
Most companies weren't that generous. IBM was the most extreme example of a big business norm in the middle of the 20th century, a norm very different than today's. Richard Silla is an economic historian at NYU.
Most corporate executives in this period when prosperity was widely shared thought, you know, that's, we can make a profit and we can take care of the workers and we want to make good profits for the products for the customers and we want to be fair to our suppliers and we want to be good citizens of the community.
Thomas Watson Jr. absolutely believed that. As the son of IBM's founder and its post-war CEO, he gave a series of speeches in the 1960s outlining the IBM values he and his father developed. As businessmen, he said, we think in terms of profits, but people continue to rank first. Years later, that would change at IBM and most big companies. But before we get there, I didn't call an economic historian for nothing, so let's review the history of the corporation, which for our purposes begins with railroads in the late 1800s. They created the first mass market in the world, coast to coast. That market allowed companies to build large, efficient, centralized factories, and with them came the first tycoons.
The corporations that were most efficient, like Rockefeller and Carnegie, Rockefeller in oil, Carnegie in steel, they grew to be very large corporations, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so America then had big business.
At their most basic level, corporations allow a group of people to put their money together. They can then grow by reinvesting their own profits and also issue stocks and bonds, growing much faster than if they had to raise and use their own cash. And so we start to get electricity and automobiles and radio, and the public starts pouring cash into the stock market. Then you know what happened next. Stock market crash, depression, New Deal, and with the New Deal came new regulations. Now companies were forced to reveal a lot of information to investors.
Wall Street hated it at the time. But not long after World War II, they realized it was probably the best thing that ever happened to them when the public, because of the New Deal regulations, had a great new confidence in Wall Street. And Wall Street boomed pretty much in the 1950s and 60s.
American companies had little competition. Most of their rivals in Europe and Japan were rebuilding after World War II's destruction.
During those two decades, I was a young man then, 1945 to 1965, American corporations pretty much had the world to themselves. Everybody was happy. You know, when we compare that time with today, we find that everybody seemed to share in the prosperity, from the corporate executives right down to the production line workers.
There was a lot of work to be done, so companies paid well, and with IBM in the lead, started to offer benefits like pensions and health care. Professor Mills of Harvard.
The notion was that there were three sources of power in the society. There was the government, of course, there was business, and there were the unions or labor. And that those three elements of the society would work together to manage its economy and its society, etc.
More companies started to look like IBM. For IBM itself, Watson Jr. was making big bets, shifting the company from mechanical tabulating devices to this new thing called a computer.
System 360, the beginning of a new age.
It paid off. Its hundreds of thousands of workers brought us into the modern computer age, leasing and servicing IBM's room-sized mainframes to companies around the world.
System 360 has the terminals.
But while IBM powered ahead, the rest of the corporate economy was running into problems. Richard Silla.
The 70s were overall a kind of decade of great problems for the U.S.
Lots of things happened at once. Spending on the Vietnam War and the war on poverty led to inflation. That made it more expensive for American companies to do business at the very moment Japan and Germany were ready to compete.
Corporations were kind of squeezed, so American corporations began to rethink their whole models.
They shifted focus almost entirely to their bottom lines.
forget about the workers, build your factory in Mexico or someplace else where labor's cheaper.
And so that's the history. At IBM, just as it had been ahead in taking care of workers, it took longer to abandon that value. It took a crisis. In the 80s, management tried to protect the mainframe business against new competition from PCs. It didn't work. In the early 90s, IBM was running out of cash. Then IBM hired its first outsider to lead the company, Louis Gerstner.
That's when IBM got a big dose of shareholder value.
One morning early on, Thomas Watson Jr. sat in the back of the car that drove Gerstner to the office. Gerstner says Watson told him to take whatever steps necessary to get the company back on track. But in many ways, the steps Gerstner took were a repudiation of the values Watson outlined in the 60s. In a speech, Gerstner said what IBM needed was, quote, a series of very tough-minded market-driven strategies. Strategies, he said, that deliver performance in the marketplace and shareholder value. IBM then, in 1993, did the unthinkable, a layoff. 60,000 workers had to go.
Basically, it was, look to the left, look to the right, some of you won't be here. I think that's when my heart went through the floor.
Marcy Holly was on IBM's communications team and among those who had to tell the world about the layoffs.
Productivity, I really feel, decreased because people were looking for jobs. People were standing in the hallways talking about, who they thought would get laid off.
Gerstner said, in effect, that IBM needed to look more like its peers. That meant also cutting back pensions and fewer perks, like those golf courses where Ron Diedrich plays.
There's so many things have changed. Just seem to be out of control.
How so?
Well, I don't know. In the past, you got rewarded for good work.
Many accounts credit Gerstner with saving IBM and moving it into services. More recently, some critics contend IBM has moved into the financial engineering business, failing to grow revenue but generating profits with strategies such as buying back its stock. Workers like Robert Ochoa, who retired last month, say the company is not the same.
It's no longer respect for the individual. It's more respect for the stockholders.
And as we'll hear more this week, IBM is not alone. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Our whole project, that is videos, timelines, and oh so much more, will be at priceofprofits.org. Updates, of course, coming all week. This final note on the way out today, in which A, we get back to the beginning of the program, the business of guns, but in which also B, I repeat myself from our broadcast of December the 14th, 2012. That was the day of the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary. I noted that day in our search for some way to quantify, some way to make sense of what had happened, that there were then more places to buy a firearm in this country than there were Starbucks on the whole planet. We looked up the latest numbers this afternoon. It's still true. The 13th of June, and we're out of here. The Dow off 132 points today, about 0.7%. The NASDAQ off 46 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 down 17 points, 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.